I am Plant Online. This is the commentary.ca. In March 2007, Deanne Whelan joined seven Canadian and Inuit Rangers on a more than 2,000-kilometer journey. The Rangers are charged with providing a military presence in isolated communities, and the journey they took was amongst some of the harshest terrain on the planet. The goal was to plant the Canadian flag at Ward Hunt Island. Deanne Whelan joins me now in this very busy week for her as a movie and a book about this journey are debuting. First, the film, This Land, screened at the Vancouver International Film Festival, while the companion book, This Vanishing Land, A Woman's Journey to the Canadian Arctic, is released by Caitlin Press. Her journey was an incredible insight into the Arctic, as well as Arctic sovereignty, climate change, and the disappearing ice shelf. Incidentally, her website is deannewhelan.com. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in Vancouver, Deanne Whelan. Good morning, Ms. Whelan.
Good morning.
Congratulations on this week.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, it's been a long time in coming. It's actually, as you mentioned, that the patrol happened in 2007, so it took 2 years to get the film made and get the book written, and there's actually also a very large interactive website that will go online within a few weeks, a new media project that the National Film Board has also done as well. So, yeah, big... like giving birth three times.
Well, when did this journey begin for you? What was the genesis of this adventure?
The journey began in January of 2007 for me. I've been a photographer for 20 years, but I saw an image of a snowmobile that was taken by a cameraman named David Henningsen. I was actually up at the Whistler Film Festival pitching a film myself, and I saw this image. And it was of a snowmobile driven by an Inuit Canadian ranger, and it had a Canadian flag on the back of it, and it was just moving across the Canadian Arctic. And for reasons that are completely irrational, that image evoked a strong emotion in me, almost like, Joseph, when you're watching a hockey game, like, let's say it's the Olympics, and it's the men's Canadian team about to go into the final against the Americans or the Russians, and they raise the Canadian flag, and they sing the anthem, and it's hard not to feel really emotional and get really welled up, you know, emotionally welled up by that. And that's what happened to me when I saw that image. And intuitively, I thought, well, that's enough. Having been a photographer and a writer for so many years, you're really looking for something. I'm looking for things that really inspire and motivate me emotionally, because then I know I'll have what it takes to see it through to the end. And the Arctic is just, it's in the newspaper every day, Joseph. It's like one page, it's like it's the next Panama Canal and the next big oil rush up there. And then you flip the page and then there's like, you know, some, the next writer is talking about, you know, how it could be an ecological crisis up there and how, you know, global warming could result in oceans rising and, you know, cities being submerged. And so you don't really know if it's the next Armageddon or the next big thing, the next big gold rush. So, you know, having those kinds of contradictions abound, I thought, and knowing that almost half of Canada is the Arctic, I thought it was the timing was right. And these sovereignty patrols have been going on since 1947. Obviously, when the North was frozen and impenetrable, it wasn't really much of an issue. Now that that's all changing, these sovereignty patrols take on a much more significant role in maintaining our domestic politics and boundaries. So I just really saw it as an opportunity and seized it.
You mentioned 1947 was when these patrols had started. That's mainly Canada that's been doing those?
Yes, Canada's been actively doing sovereignty patrols of the North since 1947. I think they've known it's not enough to just patrol the area by air. You have to have feet on the ground. A number, as we know, 28,000 Canadian Inuit living in Nunavut, our newest territory, and also which was all the lands that we traveled in are in Nunavut. The most northern coastline in North America is the northwest coast of Ellesmere Island, and that's what we traveled. And it was quite compelling. It hadn't been traveled since 1906, and this was by far the most ambitious sovereignty patrol the Canadian government had embarked upon. It cost $1 million to send seven men up there to raise a flag, and I was the embedded media on the patrol, and I went to not only film it, but also I was filing stills for Canadian press and sending video to CBC. And there's not much point in raising a flag a couple hundred miles from the North Pole on the most northern tip of land in Canada if there isn't somebody there documenting it so that the world knows we're there. And it was that argument that I used quite persuasively over a series of months to convince them to take me on the patrol.
Canada is staking claim to this part of the world. Those are other countries. Now, you mentioned that 1947 was when Canada has been doing it actively. Yes. Have other countries been doing it since?
Yes, the Danes now do kayak patrols, similar patrols in the summer months off the coast of Greenland. I think it was only 3 months after we came back, 4 months after we came back in 2007, that's when the Russians decided to respond to that Canadian initiative by putting a Russian flag on the sea bottom underneath the North Pole. A lot of this is basically a little bit of bravado right now and a little bit of PR, I guess. There's no bullets or bombs. It's just people asserting their sovereign claims to an area. And there's most of it's pretty clear cut. I guess the real challenges are the Northwest Passage, of course, which Canadians believe, the Canadian government believes, and I believe it as well, that the Northwest Passage is in fact Canadian internal waters. The Americans are contesting that. They believe it's international waters. So that's our first sort of problem right there. And then in the north, as the ice melts, they're actually, the people are laying claim to the ocean bottom. And the reason for that, of course, is because there's trillions of dollars of oil there. And it doesn't take a lot of historical research to understand that when there's oil and diamonds, you're ripe for a future conflict.
Now, the reality of climate change, you can see that firsthand in your travels there?
Yeah, it was hard to believe when it was minus 60 and you're in a whiteout for 7 days.
Right.
We hit a hurricane when we approached alert. Most people don't realize the most northern military station in the world is Canada's, and it's alert, and it's on the very northern tip of Ellesmere Island. And actually, alert is closer to Moscow than it is to Ottawa. So that's a little bit of information there. It's kind of interesting. Despite that, we traveled on a very large ice shelf called the Ward Hunt Ice Shelf. And a year later, it was in 2008, I think 150 miles of that shelf broke off and floated away. I mean, you're talking like a piece of ice bigger than New York City just cracking off and floating away. And, I mean, these ice shelves have been there for thousands of years. So there's no doubt that things are in a state of transition up there. Having spoken to some of the Inuit as well, I was quite illuminated to find out that it's not really, we call it global warming, and I think in some ways that might be the wrong term and a little bit misleading. The Inuit explained to me that it's the ice is actually melting from the bottom up. So the ocean is warming up, and that's what's melting the ice. This makes it very dangerous for them because it's hard to see. It's hard to know when hunters are going out on the ice. It's hard to tell that it's, where the weak ice is and where the strong ice is because it is melting from the bottom. And because it's the ocean warming, when the ocean warms up and it melts the ice, ultimately that can affect ocean current, and in turn that can affect air currents. So the world's climate can definitely change, but I don't think anybody can really say for sure if it's going to get warmer or it's going to get colder. I think we're living in a bit of an experiment, and only time will really tell, what will happen.
Now, you mentioned that there's some places you went were minus 60. When you go up someplace where it's extreme like that, does that change your senses? Like when you get cold here in sort of when it gets a little crisp here in Vancouver as it is today, does that not matter anymore? I guess.
It reaches a point where it just I think. After minus 50, Celsius and Fahrenheit are the same, right? So when you're dealing with minus 60 and then you have like another 50 or 60, kilometer wind on top of that, yeah, how do you describe minus 90 or minus 100, right?
Yeah.
I can tell you, though, that the Army outfitted me with a standard kit for the mission, because it was an Army mission. So I was wearing about 80 pounds of clothing most of the time, multiple layers, And, you know, some of the guys on the trip, especially the scout, Alan Pogatok, he's the Canadian Ranger who was a scout on our mission. And the job is most dangerous for him because we travel in a straight line of eight. And you're in a fixed position in that line. You're always traveling in the same position. So the guy that's going first, if anyone's going to fall through the ice in a snowmobile or hit a hidden ice block or something and be thrown off his machine, it's your scout. So he really got quite a bit of bad frostbite on his face on the journey. I had a little bit on my face and came close to losing a few toes at one point. The thing about the cold is it's somewhat insidious because you don't really, it goes numb, right? When something starts to freeze on you, it goes numb, so you actually don't feel anything. And it's only when it starts to thaw out that it hurts. And then you're like, why are my toes feeling like they're screaming at me right now? And that's when you pull off your boot and suddenly realize, oh my gosh, you know, I'm well on my way to getting frostbite here.
Throughout the journey, were there moments where you said, well, you know, what the hell am I doing here?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But I was certainly in good hands. And, I mean, like I said, I was a photographer for 20 years. Now I'm making documentaries. This was my first mid-length feature doc. And it was really amazing to do it with the National Film Board. I can't say enough about how lucky we are in Canada to have something like the National Film Board. You know, the film is the most powerful artistic medium of our time. And it's really important, I think, that at some point you can be sincere and authentic about your stories. And National Film Board has won more Oscars than anyone in the world. They've been around for 70 years. And same with Caitlin Press. You know, it's another small, independent Canadian publishing company. So it's a Canadian story, all, you know, through and through, told by a Canadian, in film by the National Film Board, in book by Caitlin Press. So I'm really proud of that. I'm really proud of that a great deal. And I'll tell you another thing I'm really proud of is, you know, being on this trip, you know, I was with the commanding officer from Quebec, I was with a sergeant from New Brunswick, and I was with Inuit gentlemen from all over the Arctic. And really, we are very much different people. But the one thing that we all had in common was we all love this land. You know, we love our country. And that was great, 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 great feeling.
And unless you go there, and unless you live there, you mentioned there's about, what, 28,000 Inuit up there?
Yes.
You don't get a good sense of what the North is or what it means. What should it mean to people that haven't been there, people down south like myself?
Well, what it should mean to you is that it's half your country, that whatever happens to the North will affect all of us directly. It's in a state of transition right now, and I think that sovereignty needs to mean more than just protecting natural resources. I think sovereignty needs to mean protecting all life and protecting the people who live on the land. So I think now's the time to really consider all of this. The army works for the government, and the government works for us. And if the democratic process is going to work here, it means actually just caring about it a little bit, thinking about it a little bit. What do we want? You know, do we want to go up there and exploit the hell out of it and get rich for 50 years? Or do we want to really take our time, work with the Inuit people, support, I mean, their knowledge of the land and what's best for all of us. And I'm not anti-development, but I am definitely all for sustainable development and respecting the land that's there and the people that are there. And, you know, I think that's really the main thing that I came home with anyway, is just it's beautiful, it's immense, it's vast, and it's fragile. You know, the Arctic is a desert. That's something I didn't realize before I went there. In fact, it gets the same amount of moisture as the Sahara Desert. Gets 4 millimeters of snow or rain a year. And when we were traveling in 7 days of whiteout, I thought it was just fresh snow falling from the sky. And then the guys just looked at me and went, no, 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 that's just the same snow blowing around and around and around every day. It's like the snow up there is really fine. It's like almost like a powder. And, it just the winds howl and just reconfigure the landscape daily. It's with deserts and desert ecologies, you're dealing with the most sensitive ecology on the planet. And I guess that's another reason why we have to be careful with development. I mean, we live in, you know, beautiful BC, we're living in a rainforest, so we can chop all our trees down, and 50 years later, the trees are back. Other ecologies don't have that bounce back, you know. You can take an ATV out on the Arctic tundra, and 100 years from now, those imprints will still be there on the ground, you know. So we have to, I think it's just about, I intentionally tried not to write a preachy book or make a preachy film. I just tried to show people what I experienced and talked about what I experienced and hope that people will make up their own mind. I mean, that's really the beauty of the true democratic process is if it's more about just activating that right now, igniting that in people and hoping that they care.
From the people that you've encountered there, are they generally hopeful on these issues, the sovereignty issue and the environmental issue?
Yep. The what was the first part, Joseph?
The people up north and the people that you've encountered, the people doing the patrols and so on, the people that you've come across in this journey, are they generally hopeful?
Yes. I think they are aware that there's a lot going on right now. Well, I mean, that one of the greatest interviews I really, my second unit director did with this guy named Ludi. He lives in Greece Fjord, which is the most northern inhabited community in the world. There's only 140 of them there. And he's been there since he was a child, and he's in his 40s now, and he's like, you know, he can tell you, you know, things are changing. I mean, the seals are molting at the wrong time of the year, you know. There's, like, where there used to be glaciers, there's no more glaciers anymore. But the pack ice is changing. And as he said, the south is moving north, you know. And I think when he said that, he wasn't just talking about the weather, you know. A lot of, with the change in climate, there's a lot of mineral and oil exploration going on right now. It's the new gold rush for a lot of people. If you look at the history of the Arctic, since the 1600s, people have been trying to find a way through the Northwest Passage, right? And finally, that long sort of corporate ambition is finally coming to fruition. So, yeah, they're hopeful, but they're also, they really are trying to become involved politically with the process. The great thing about the creation of Nunavut in 1999 is it's giving the Inuit people a lot more political clout and allowing them to get involved and ensuring that any mining or oil or gas or whatever happens, that it doesn't affect the quality of their meat. I mean, this is what's so funny about the world freaking out about seal hunting, really. Is the seal is the cow to the Inuit people, you know? That's their main staple of their diet. So obviously they care a great deal about preserving the integrity of those animals, right? They don't want to, whatever happens to the diet of those animals will happen to their diet. And, you know, up until 50 or 60 years ago, a lot of these communities never saw cancer, you know, ever.
Right.
And in fact, interestingly enough, the cancer showed up right around the time that the Western diet showed up, you know, the frozen pizzas and the cookies.
Yeah.
So I think I'd like to say that, you know, they are hopeful. You think about what they've lived through for the last 4,000 years, the harshest climate on the planet. They're obviously resilient. You know, they're a very positive people anyway. I mean, they don't believe in fear. Fear will get you killed in the Arctic, you know. If you're in a bad storm and you start getting afraid, that could mean imminent death, you know. They confront their fear and adversity with big smiles and positive attitudes. But having said that, I think they know they're going through a time of transition right now, and it's really important for them that I think they are proud to be Canadian, and I think it's important that the rest of Canada be just as proud that we're, you know, that they are Canadian as well. We need to support them in the future in terms of, like, supporting their desire to protect their land as well as, you know, they want jobs for their youth, so they want sustainable development. I think it's just a question of the rest of Canada really supporting that, not telling them what they should do, but supporting them in the decisions that they make.
Now, I understand the next project for you is Everest.
Yes.
And what is your plan there? You're going to
I'm going to try to spend 40 days at base camp. In fact, that's what the film is called, 40 Days at Base Camp. And base camp on Mount Everest is at 17,500 feet. And I went there for Outpost Magazine 2 years ago, and, you know, I'd been to Outward Bound as a young teenager and always saw the mountain as sort of the metaphor for the pinnacle of human achievement. And so when I got to Everest Base Camp, 17,000 feet, and I saw these people from all around the world there, and it was the darkest place I've ever been to in my life. It was like Lord of the Flies, you know. People were stealing each other's oxygen tanks and a lot of high crime going on up there in the mountain. So something went terribly wrong. I don't, you know, something went terribly wrong between 1950 when Hillary and Tenzing first summited the mountain, and there was a certain nobility and authenticity associated with that, and that's gone. So in my mind, if the mountain truly is a metaphor, then if we can sort of figure out what went wrong at Everest, it might have a might be a moral to that story that extends beyond the mountain.
Well, we'll await that work, but until then, we'll see the movie, we'll see the documentary, and we'll read the book.
Right on.
Deanne, this has been a fascinating conversation. It's a fascinating story and a most instructive one. Congratulations and continued good luck with it.
Thank you so much, Joseph.
You're very welcome. Deanne Whelan on the line. Her film, This Land, just debuted at the Vancouver International Film Festival. The book on the journey, This Vanishing Land, is out now from Caitlin Press. DeanneWhelan.com is her website in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.